The great Robert Louis Stevenson has long been one of my favorites, not just as a great writer, but as a man as well. Plagued by a frail body and poor health, destined to die at just 44 years of age, he put more living, more travel, and more work and talent into his short time here on Earth than a million so-called average men. The author of Treasure Island, Kidnap, Dr. Jekyll, and Mr. Hyde, Stevenson once wrote in a small essay, "As courage and intelligence are the two qualities best worth a good man's cultivation." That's good, isn't it? Courage and intelligence. So it is the first part of intelligence to recognize our precarious estate in life, and the first part of courage to be not at all abashed before the fact. A frank and somewhat headlong carriage, not looking too anxiously before, not dallying in maudlin regret over the past, stamps the man who is well armored for this world, and not only well armored for himself, but a good friend and a good citizen to boot. We do not go to cowards for tender dealings. There is nothing so cruel as panic. The man who has least fear for his own carcass has most time to consider others. So soon as prudence has begun to show up in the brain like a dismal fungus, it finds its first expression in the paralysis of generous acts. The victim begins to shrink spiritually. He develops a fancy for parlors with a regulated temperature. The care of one important body and soul becomes so engrossing that all the noises of the outer world begin to come thin and faint into the parlor with the regulated temperature. He makes some important points in those few words, don't you think? The first and most important being that the two qualities best worth a good man or woman's cultivation are courage and intelligence, and that it's the first part of intelligence to recognize a very precarious estate in life and thus not play it too safely. There's no way to win that game. Tiptoeing through life won't change the final outcome. As soon as too much prudence begins to show up in the brain like a dismal fungus, it finds its first expression in a paralysis of generous acts. The victim begins to shrink and so on. Some people worry so much about the future that they fail entirely to enjoy today. William Lyon Phelps once pointed out that we look backward too much and we look forward too much. Thus we miss the passing moment. In our regrets and apprehensions, we miss the only eternity of which man can be absolutely sure, the eternal present, for it is always now. The fear of life is the favorite disease of the 20th century. Too many people are afraid of tomorrow. Their happiness is poisoned by a phantom. Many are afraid of old age, forgetting that even if they should lose their bodily vigor, weakness itself may minister to the development of the mind and spirit. Instead of chagrin over the past and alarm over the future, suppose we consider our opportunity. As Emerson put it, write in on your heart that every day is the best day in the year. No man has earned anything lightly until he knows that every day is doomsday. Today is a king in disguise. A small lesson from three great minds, Stevenson, Phelps, and Emerson. Courage and intelligence are the two qualities best worth our cultivation, and don't play it too safe. The man who has least fear for his own carcass has most time to consider others. There's a little green paperback book entitled The Gospel of Emerson, put together by Newton Dilloway and published by Unity Books, Lee's Summit, Missouri. It's a book which, if you read it quietly and thoughtfully, will be a marvelous new piece in understanding. Emerson was one of the truly gifted intellectual giants of all time. He saw things with a wonderful clarity through layers of the obvious and commonplace to the kernel of truth that lay within. In reading the little book on Emerson, I came across this line hidden down at the end of a paragraph. People wish to be settled. Only as far as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. You know, that takes some thinking to understand, but it's one of those statements we know intuitively to be true. Even though we strive to become settled and seek the mirage of security, we know that we do our best, think our best, accomplish most, and most certainly live more fully when we're unsettled. As Emerson put it, only as far as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. In other words, feel there's no what's good for us. There's a security of a kind available to each of us, more than we require, really, but it's inside, not outside. It's to be found in the development of ourselves as creative, productive beings, loving and thinking persons. That real security is to be found. It cannot be outside of us. If we're not secure as persons, we will only stew and worry about any other sort of security of being settled. And so we usually strive hardest for a chimera, and that's what often brings so much disillusionment in later life, when people begin to sit around and stare at each other and wonder what they've been up to. Being settled is all right for cows and goldfish, I suppose, although I'm not at all sure about that. But being subtle doesn't seem to work at all with human beings. They get nervous and querulous, start snapping at each other. They also get fat and sloppy and turn inward upon themselves and get unhappy expressions on their faces when they've been settled for very long. They find that the very thing for which they've striven for so long is not what they want at all. It's the fun of the journey, but usually in belated retrospect it really matters. It's while they're striving that they reach their heights. Only as far as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. How often a successful man hears his wife say, "It was a lot more fun when we were living in a walk-up apartment and counting our pennies to make ends meet. We were happiest then." And the fact is that they probably were. But did they know it then? Living on the edge, striving toward goals still fairly distant, brings out the best or the very worst in people. If they're wise, it brings out the best. If they're ignorant, it can bring out the worst. But being settled, having it made, as we say, seldom brings with it much enthusiasm. And Emerson also said, "Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm, and we are most enthusiastic when we are as yet unsettled." There are many paradoxes in life, and one is that while people wish to be settled, it is only as far as they are unsettled that there's any hope for them. John Handy, president of Handy Associates, New York Consultants, has said that one out of every three middle managers could be fired with more gain than loss to his company. And that's especially true in larger companies, says Mr. Handy. Calling him, every third middle manager, calling him the corporate parasite, Handy says he fits the following description. He never makes a meaningful decision that helps increase profits. He spouts cliches and bromides when confronted with a question or problem. His time schedule is vague. He's never presented with or always manages to avoid a task which demands measurable results. He constantly asks questions and seldom presents ideas. He's never under any real pressure to produce. He's a fence sitter who skillfully manages always to wind up on the winning side. And when he's on vacation, things go just as smoothly without him. What about the manager of tomorrow? What will be required of him or her? What kind of person will he or she be? The Research Institute of America interviewed more than 100 company presidents to determine what makes today's manager a success, theorizing that this might reveal a key to the question. Four major qualities were repeatedly identified. The first was ability to manage. That includes not only the ability to get things done through others, but the ability to manage one's own affairs successfully. Two, fiscal responsibility. The most effective managers were adept not only at obtaining financial reports from their own operations, but were extremely resourceful at getting and interpreting financial reports from competitors. Three, involvement in the future. Many of the top people felt that middle management concerned itself too much with the present, under the assumption that the top brass should take care of the future. Yet alert middle managers were often in a better position to spot trends and opportunities before they come to the attention of top management. And four, professional competence. Knowledge becomes obsolete quickly today. An effective manager carries on a continuing program of self-education in his field. The management of business is often and quite aptly compared with the parent. So I suppose it can be said that the good parent will follow along much the same lines. Manage one's own affairs as well as get things done through others. Fiscal responsibility, handling finances wisely, making sure there's a profit left over at the bottom line at the end of the year. Involvement in the future, planning ahead, alert for opportunities. And professional competence, involving a never-ending program of self-education through study. And the good manager and parent says to those in his charge, "You can become anything you seriously want to become. My job is to help you become it." That kind of statement has a double-barreled effect. First, it indicates that we should all be striving for something. And second, it indicates a willingness to help. Attached to the telephone of a young executive of my acquaintance is a small sign that reads, "God give me the wisdom to be as smart as my customers." You know, there's a ton of good sense and worlds of growth opportunity lurking in that small, pithy comment. If there's one attitude common among those who serve the buying public, it's often an attitude which says, "Okay, dummy, what'll it be?" It's an attitude which makes the mistake of assuming that because I work in this business, I know all there is to know about it, while the customer doesn't know anything about it at all. Because of that situation, I am infinitely wise, while the customer I now see approaching is infinitely stupid. Now, I don't mean to say that all who serve the public feel that way by any means. A good percentage of them are great and a joy to do business with, and we remember them and go back to them whenever we can. And I don't mean to pick on the salespeople or the service people particularly. The boss is the one who frequently makes the mistake of underestimating the public, or assumes most people are as dumb as he is. Some time back, I was checking into a motel, and soon I was back at the desk, asking them to make reservations for me somewhere else. The girl asked me what was wrong, and I simply said, "Your motel isn't good enough." Traveling is tough enough without having to stay in a small, dirty room with an indifferent shower that goes from scalding hot one minute to ice cold the next, with a tile and plaster falling off the walls and ceiling. They underestimate the customer, or feel they have a lock on business whether the customer likes it or not. The primary function of any organization is to help man enjoy a more meaningful existence. That little legend ought to be cast in bronze and put every place in a business firm. The primary function of any organization is to help man enjoy a more meaningful existence. Now, if it isn't meeting that qualification, the people in it should get into something else, should give some thought to going straight. The definition of genius is to think in unhabitual ways. A day should never pass in which people in business do not ask themselves, how can we do a better job of serving our customers? But the number of businessmen who ask themselves that question every day, you could fit easily into the back seat of a Volkswagen. Instead of concentrating on the cash register, if they would concentrate more on serving the customer, the cash register would take care of itself. We shouldn't get our causes and effects mixed up. By making our product or service right, all else will fall into place. It's just a matter of time and perseverance. But we should never underestimate the customer and his natural desire for quality, for value, for his time and money. The business people who have heeded that kind of thinking have prospered. Anyway, it's a good idea, that little sign. God give me the wisdom to be as smart as my customers. And we might add, and to serve them as I enjoy being served when positions are reversed. And that business of thinking in unhabitual ways can also bring a fresh, clean breath of renewal into a business. Imagination, you know, is everything. Wilfred A. Peterson, author of The Art of Living in the World Today, writing in Science of Mind magazine some time back, quoted Felix Adler, who once said, "I am grateful for the idea that has used me." And Peterson went on to say, there are millions of great ideas in the world waiting for men and women to use them, for people to dedicate their minds, hearts, spirits, eyes, ears, hands, arms, and legs to putting those ideas into action. There's no lack of ideas waiting to be used. There's only a lack of people willing to use them. The idea of the electric light used Edison. The idea of flying the Atlantic used Lindbergh. The idea of saving the Union used Lincoln. The idea of building a hospital in Africa used Schweitzer. The idea of writing Uncle Tom's Cabin used Harriet Beecher Stowe. Ideas use men when men work for those ideas, when men are dominated by those ideas and make them a part of themselves. The ideas need not be world-shaking. Ideas may be limited and yet meaningful. The idea of a new school in the community, the idea of a new church. There are ideas for thousands of projects that will contribute in large or small measure to mankind. Ideas of themselves do nothing. Used by men, they can do anything. The idea of peace is a great idea, perhaps the very greatest, that men should open themselves to and be used by. The idea of war has been used by man for far too long a time. It sent millions marching to their death, destroyed cities, wrecked the world. We need to be gripped by the idea of peace. We should get it into our hearts, into our bloodstreams, into our bones, and make it a part of ourselves. It's been waiting around for a long time for men to use. The supply of great ideas is inexhaustible. Let a great idea use you. Stand up for it, work for it, teach it, sell it, crusade for it. Help a great idea to become a reality through you. Well, I think that's a great little piece, because it should make clear to those who are searching for something to do, some kind of work to get into, a way in which they can not only find something to do, but at the same time be swept up and along by an idea that's bigger than they are. Find an idea you think is interesting and exciting and jump into it with both feet, head, hands, and heart. Let a great idea use you. A great idea might be to build and operate the best business of its kind. Marshall Field had that idea. Great restaurants, hardware stores, supermarkets, any sort of business. You don't have to make a great invention or win the Nobel Peace Prize. A business motivated by a great idea will succeed out of all proportion to a business operating only for profit. So will a career in anything. Selling, law, medicine, farming. A person moved by an idea that's bigger than he is can move a lot of mountains during his lifetime. A great idea is like a broad, swift river. Once you've found the one you want, all you have to do is jump in and start swimming. It'll carry you along much faster than you could have traveled otherwise. In the world of today, it seems that each of us needs to choose between one of three courses. Recognizing that we are undergoing changes unprecedented in human history, we can choose to escape from the world, to help build a better world, or to just hang on for dear life and hope that the whole thing doesn't fly apart during our lifetimes? How about you? Which course are you taking? Sometimes I think it's possible to escape and help in the reconstruction. In Lewis Mumford's book, The Story of Utopias, he talks about some of these things. It isn't that things are necessarily bad now. Much is very good. Much is almost too good, it seems, for people who have not learned to cope with success, but nothing or very little is as it was. We're in a whole new ballgame, and it takes some shifting of gears. We found, for example, that affluence does not satisfy wants. It simply creates new ones, more voracious, more difficult to satisfy than the old ones. Utopia involves the satisfaction of wants, as Mumford points out, but the wants of man are insatiable. Supply one, and two rise to take its place. And man is the only creature so constituted. Satisfy the wants of an animal, and he'll drop off into a peaceful sleep, totally content. Not man. Satisfy man's wants, and his eyes bug out looking for new ones. That's one of the reasons there's no end in sight to the possible growth of business, which is, in many ways, good. The same technology that created the monsters which terrify us now, overpopulation, pollution, wars, and crime, can contain them. Ultimately do away with them entirely, I'm sure. Technology gives us what we want. And then it lets us see, as a New York University professor put it, that while dissatisfaction may be uncomfortable, the real disasters in life come from getting what we want. But only temporarily, during man's painful maturing process. Of the three choices open to us, escape, reconstruction, or teeth gritting and hanging on, I think most of us want to help put things together in a better way. And one way each of us can do that is to strive for quality in whatever it is we do. Simplify our lives. Cut down on the number of things we'll permit to engage our attention and make sure they're of good quality. When you're building on quality, you're building on long-term growth. If we refuse to let junk appear in our lives, it will disappear from our lives. If we refuse to buy things we think are priced too high, the prices will come down. We can make do with what we've got. If the homes in the new development all look exactly alike and there are no trees, let's don't buy one. And let's don't buy anything that has not been well constructed to last a long time. Let's carefully examine and check out things before we'll permit them to enter our lives. And most importantly of all, let's make sure that what we do is of the best quality possible. The late Pearl Buck, famed author of The Good Earth and Nobel Prize winner, wrote something for Modern Maturity magazine some time back, which was reprinted in Science of Mind, that all people, I think, might do well to read. Let me quote just a bit of it. She wrote, "Life is a continuing process. This much I'm sure of, and this much I state on a fine sunny morning as I reflect upon the fact that I've begun to live the 80th year of my life. It's an enjoyable year. I'm in good health, I have much work to do, and I enjoy myself and what I do. I sit in a comfortable room, my work table faces a window which gives me a charming view of a country road winding up a hill. It's the main street of a small village, Denby, in the state of Vermont. We've been coming to Vermont, my family and I, for some 20 years to spend summers, to celebrate Christmas, to enjoy skiing. Now the children have married and gone their way. Their father has preceded me into the next stage of life, whatever it is. And so I'm alone, and yet never alone. Around me is the village life. Here in my house is the life I find in books, in music, and above all in work. I do not know what people mean when they speak of being old. I do not know because I do not know where life begins, if indeed there is a beginning. And I don't know where it ends, if indeed there is an end. I know that I'm in a stage, a phase, a period of life. I enter this stage at birth. I shall end this stage with death. For me, death is merely the entrance into further existence. I do not know what this existence will be, but then I did not know what existence in this stage would be when I was born into it. I did not ask to be, but I have been and I am. And my reason tells me I shall continue to be. I am on my way somewhere, just as I was on the day of my birth. Young and old are for me meaningless words, except as we use them to denote where we are in the process of this stage of being. Would I wish to be young again? No. For I have learned too much to wish to lose it. I have reached an honorable position in life, because I am old and no longer young. I'm far more valuable person today than I was 50 years ago, or 40 years ago, or 30, 20, or even 10. I've learned so much since I was 70. I believe I can honestly say that I've learned more in the last 10 years than I learned in any previous decade. This, I suppose, is because I've perfected my techniques so that I no longer waste time in learning how to do what I have to do, which is what I also want to do. There will be those who question my certainty of a continuing existence. My belief is based upon sound scientific reasons and long acquaintance with some of the greatest scientists and philosophers of our times. Religious faith and scientific hypotheses are much nearer to the same conclusions than is commonly realized. Serious studies in parapsychology are being conducted in various countries, and the results are remarkable and will someday be made known. Let us take thought. Let us reflect, we who have spent our years. Let us see what can be done in the remaining years. This from a distinguished writer and thinker as she moved into her 80th year, the Nobel Prize-winning author. She also commented, imagine that she had learned more in the decade from her 70th birthday to her 80th than in any previous time of her life. As to her belief in the continuation of life, she wrote, for the present, I content myself with two true anecdotes which express in simple terms the silence between this life and next. The first occurred in my own family soon after the death of my husband, who was much loved by his grandchildren, Susan, then age 5, and Ricky, age 3. The occasion was a family picnic, and I overheard the following conversation. Ricky, why doesn't Grandfather come to the picnic? Susan, he can't come because he's up in heaven. Ricky, why doesn't he come down? Susan, he can't find the ladder. It's truly spoken, Burlbuck wrote, out of the mouth of a babe. He does not come down because he can't find the ladder. The techniques of communication are just not complete. The second anecdote was given me through a letter by an unknown woman. In effect, it was as follows. When my small children could not understand the silence between their recently dead father and us, who loved him so dearly, I explained by describing to them the life cycle of the dragonfly. It begins as a grub in water. Then, at the proper moment, it surfaces, finds it has wings, and flies away. I suppose I told them that the ones left in the water wonder where he went and why he doesn't come back. But he can't, because he has wings. Nor can they go to him, because they don't have wings yet. Something like that is true, I believe, Pearlbuck wrote. Something like that is true. We haven't our wings yet either, but someday... I remember reading something she wrote many years ago when she compared the fear of death with the fear of leaving the womb into life. The late Ernest Holmes wrote something we do well to remember every morning as we begin our day. He said, create or perish is the eternal mandate of nature. Be constructive or become frustrated is an equal demand. We do not all have to act or think alike, but each should give full rein to the urge within him to express his life. This thing called life is intimate to everyone, even as the law of cause and effect is available to all. Take your place, then, in the universe in which you live, having neither fear nor arrogance, but in the simplicity of faith come to believe that you are one with the creative genius back of this vast array of ceaseless motion, this original flow of life. You are as much a part of it as the sun, the earth, and the air. There's something in you telling you this, like a voice echoing from some mountaintop of inward vision, like a light whose origin no man has seen, like an impulse welling up from an invisible source. Your mind is an outlet through which the creative intelligence of the universe seeks fulfillment. It's good, isn't it? And powerful. It reminds me of Emerson's great quote that we should listen to the voice within. Create or perish, be constructive or become frustrated. We may dread the work that lies ahead of us tomorrow, but we should dread even more a time when we will have nothing at all to do tomorrow, when there's nothing for us to do. And so, let's create. Let's bring something new, something better because of us, to our work, which is what creation is all about. There are all kinds of people in the world. There are the bizarre, the decadent, the bored, the disenchanted. There are the mindless hedonists, the shallow seekers of distraction. There are the glib cynics to whom nothing is or can be good or meaningful. But the happiest people on earth are those who, out of themselves, create conditions beneficial to those it has been given them to serve. They create happy homes, good meals, education, better health, enjoyment, humor, new buildings, products, services, a better job, a helping hand, better government. Wherever they are, things are better for their having been born. They bring something of themselves to their work, something that makes it better. They are constructive. They are the builders of the world. They listen to the iron string that vibrates deep within them, of which Emerson spoke. Ernest Holmes went on to say, the greatest gift life could have made to you is yourself. You are a spontaneous, self-choosing center in life, and the great drama of being, the great joy of becoming, the certainty of eternal expansion. You could not ask for more, and more could not have been given. You need not mold your life after another. Trust yourself. Believe in your direct relationship with life, and you will not be disappointed. But do not wait. Today is the time to start. Right where you are is the place to begin. Thank you.